Radio.
The Beat, 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
A very good afternoon, everybody. Flight to Classics is brought to you by 4Play Deli Sheraton Mall and this radio station, The Beat 104, in a class by itself.
Trini Guyanese cuisine at its best.
4Play Deli's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
4Play Deli.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile, got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at 4Play Deli. We got the taste you won't forget.
4Play Deli, located in Sheraton Mall.
Good afternoon and welcome aboard Flight 104 to Classics. Today, our aircraft is under the command of Captain Phil Forrester. The captain has informed me that our flying time will be approximately 3 hours to Classics International Airport. At this time, we ask that you fasten your seatbelts and increase the volume levels in your system as we perform our demonstration. Thank you for your attention. We will be airborne shortly.
Oh yeah, I like it a lot. A very good afternoon, everybody. Captain Forrester is once again in the cockpit of this magnificent aircraft. And we are heading to Classics International Airport. Flying time to our destination is 3 hours. And this afternoon we'll be soaring to an incredulous altitude of 104,000 feet. Oh yeah. Now, this afternoon, we'll be using runway 09. Therefore, we'll be taking off towards the east of the island. And those sitting to the left of the aircraft will notice the impressive Crane Beach Hotel. Samos Castle will be a little further. And the Bridgetown Port will be away in the distance to our left. Now, you'll notice that the Animal Flower Cave will be sitting there beautifully, right on the edge of the northeastern coast of Barbados, right there. And as we exit the island, those sitting to the right will notice the billowing smoke coming out of the cement plant there in Checker Hall, St. Lucie. So quite frankly, there is a whole lot to see on the way. And we travel over the northern coast of St. Lucia, Groseley, and Cap Estates will be directly below us. We go a little further on a left turn over Martinique into the Western Caribbean. On our way to Classics International Airport, there's going to be a little bit of bumpiness as we exit Barbados, but once we reach our cruising altitude of 10,000 feet, we'll be totally okay. And is it that at that time, we'll be serving our delicious meals from 4Play Deli Sheraton Mall, all of our rotis that you like a lot, and those fresh beverages, lemonade, sorrel, and mango. Oh yeah, mango is in season, so yeah, we have mango juices on board our flight this afternoon that will be served lavishly as well. Now, I have to let you know, just in case you didn't, I am the ordained minister of Classics. Therefore, I'll be playing you some delightful ones this afternoon. There'll be oceans of smiles on your beautiful faces. All of you will enjoy absolutely all the songs we'll play on our flight to Classics International Airport. So, really, it's going to be great this afternoon. Sit back, relax, enjoy. Flight to Classics, brought to you by 4Play Deli Sheraton Mall on this radio station. Flight attendants, prepare for departure and cross-check.
Trini Guyanese cuisine at its best.
4Play Deli's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
4Play Deli.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile, got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at 4Play Deli. We got the taste you won't forget.
4Play Deli, located in Sheraton Mall.
The Beat 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
I mentioned how temperamental the weather has been over the last couple of weeks. You know, it's been raining and then the sun has been coming out. But I have to say to you that the damage has been done, though. We've noticed how the heat has ravaged the skin tone of many Barbadians, the extent to which there has been this rush for bleaching cream. You know what I'm saying? But now, the law of diminishing returns apparently is now applicable to bleaching creams as it relates to Barbadians, because they're saying now, I saw it online this morning, that bleaching cream works better for Jamaicans. I don't know about that though. I'm not going to get into that kind of insular.
But he's done. I'm not want them to call up with ear, making a whole heap of argument.
Hop here. You know, I think it is ridiculous. It is insular, and there's no physiological or biological evidence that has been presented to support that argument.
Diminishing return for some.
Well, the more something used, right, the less the result. For example, if you're really, really thirsty, mm-hmm, and you have one glass of water, mm-hmm, the second one does not taste
as good as the first.
That's
right.
It's called diminishing returns. That's what it is.
There we go.
So so bleaching creams and diminishing returns, there is a problem there. But having said that, after all that intellectual kind of language, let me tell you about the weather. The present temperature is 30 degrees Celsius. The relative humidity is 75%. The wind is blowing from the east at 35 kilometers per hour. The tide is high at the moment, but it will recede tonight at 8 minutes after 8 o'clock. The sun will set in northwest at 6:21 this evening, but it will rise gloriously from the east at 5:32 tomorrow morning. The forecast for the rest of the afternoon: partly cloudy with just a few intermittent showers. And you know, I just love celebrating women, the distance they've come, and we speak so often on this flight about their achievements. And I'm not being gender preferential, by the way. I'm just seeing that I've seen how women have incrementally developed themselves, and it's quite frankly truly amazing the ways in which young Barbadian women are now empowering themselves through higher education. And in so doing, they're not only contributing substantially to Barbados' national development, but are showcasing their incredible skills in other highly competitive geographical spaces of the world. Today's featured guest is a perfect example of what I just mentioned. She received her secondary education at Harrison's College before earning a degree in medicine from the University of the West Indies Cavo campus. That was in 2018. It is indeed my incredible delight to welcome on board Flight to Classics incoming ophthalmology resident at Howard University, Washington, D.C., Dr. Kirsten DeSilver. Good afternoon, Dr. DeSilver. Welcome. I was going to call you Kirsten, but it's a breach of protocol.
It's fine. Good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that introduction.
Well, thank you so much indeed. And welcome back to Barbados.
Thank you.
So what does coming back to Barbados mean to you every time? I was going to be presumptuous and say it means that that rice and curry from Fort Bridge Deli.
Absolutely. That's one thing I always tell my parents, is one of the first things I need to eat is some curry from Fort Bridge Deli. But coming home is always nice. Mm-hmm. The weather, mm-hmm, is the one thing that hits as soon as you get off the plane. Mm-hmm. But being able to be around friends and family after being away for such a long time, there's no other feeling like it.
But you know, because you have done so much, and it just for some reason seems longer than you have actually been. But having said that, I'd like to congratulate you on your extraordinary achievements as a young physician. Well done. Awesome is the word. Congratulations to
Thank
you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Now, I mentioned earlier about the extent to which you've excelled academically, but it all began here at Harrison's College. Tell us first about those days at Harrison's College. How was it?
Well, it would be remiss of me to not correct you, but it's Harrison.
Harrison College. I apologize.
Yes, Harrison College. And I mean, that's where, you know, that's the school that brought me to where I was. It was very challenging coming from primary school where, you know, you're the top of your class, and then you're entering a school where everyone else is the tops of their class. But my Harrison College days were definitely some of the most fun times. So yeah, that's where it all started.
Excellent. Now, you were deputy head girl at the school and also president of the graduating class committee.
Yes.
What was your role as deputy head girl?
So we were chosen by the faculty, the staff, for academic excellence and being a role model for the school, the heads and deputy head girl and boy. But our role was specifically to oversee the prefect corps. Mm-hmm. So we would also ensure that classes, if they were unattended by teachers, were attended by a prefect. And we would fill in for the head girl and head boy at school events, you know, if we had to do votes of thanks in their absence.
So I want to ask you this. Most students at secondary school kind of identify the direction which their career ambition is going to lead. Did you ever imagine back then, though, that you would be one day striding through those doors of the renowned and prestigious Howard University, Washington, D.C.?
You know, I always wanted to pursue further education abroad. That was definitely something I wanted to do. I didn't have a specific school in mind, and I initially wanted to do medical school abroad, but when it came to the time, financially, it made sense to stay in Barbados. And I have no regrets about that. That was probably one of the best decisions. Mm. And so, no, I didn't expect to be going to Howard, but I've had the opportunity to study and work at different institutions in the United States. So I'm really blessed to be finally going to Howard University. That's where our people are. And I get to be surrounded and learn from people who are like me.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, let's talk about your career option. I suppose there were loads of choices in relation to this, considering your outstanding academic achievement at Harrison College. I'm talking about 10 ones and two. And a two.
And 1-2, yes.
And 1-2. Now, that's incredible, though. It really is incredible. But I want to know, why medicine?
I can't pinpoint the time that I chose to do medicine. I was asking my parents about this before I came, actually, and you know, they said, I always said I wanted to cure people. But I will say, when I was about 13 years old, I got really ill and I spent some time in the hospital. And it was the first time that I had to see an ophthalmologist after Miss Geeta Sajeev. I love her. Mm-hmm. And after I came out of the hospital. And I think that was the first time that I felt what it was like to be cared for. And I told myself, this is what I want to do for other people. And I think maybe that was that aha moment for me going forward. But I think I ultimately liked sciences. And so I went along the medicine track.
So that experience of yours essentially or largely would have contributed to your decision to do medicine. Now, you earned your degree from the University of the West Indies Cahill campus in 2018 before doing your internship here at the QEH Hospital. But it's important, though, for us to speak about that structure of financial and moral support your adoring parents, Rupert and Joanne De Silva, provided in order to give you that shot to what you've become today.
Yes, I owe them everything. Mm-hmm. From the inception, they've always been my biggest supporters, emotionally, financially, mentally. And I know, especially after I left Barbados, they had to sacrifice so much for me in ways that I probably will never understand or the extent to. Yeah. But so I owe them a debt of gratitude. I tell my mom all the time, as soon as I've completed my studies, I'm going to retire them.
Oh my goodness.
But, you know, it goes beyond parents, and I'm not diminishing them, but my extended family, my grandparents, my uncles and aunts, my friends, my family friends, they've all, you know, been some of the best support that I've had, and I can't not mention them as well.
I can see the tears running down, the desperate tears running down their faces, especially your mom. I mean, it's truly awesome. I mean, I am proud of you.
Thank you.
Having known you for a long time, congratulations. Yes. Once again. Now, I want to talk about this, though, because separation anxiety is seldom spoken about in Barbados. But the truth is, many parents go through this when their child, especially if it's their only child, goes overseas to study. What was it like for your parents?
I think my mom took it a lot harder than my dad did. Mm. I was ready to leave, but again, as you said, I am an only child, so I'm their only baby. I'm a woman into a brand new country where I am a minority. It was difficult in the beginning. My mom would text all the time, and if I don't respond, it's, are you okay? But over time, I think it got better. You know, they began to trust that I know what I'm doing.
Yes.
I'm making wise decisions most of the time. And they have to give you that trust eventually. And now it's, you know, it's been about 4 years. So it's a lot easier today.
And I suppose 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the days of Bartel and overseas calls.
Oh my gosh.
They would have been bankrupt by now.
Definitely.
Thank God for technology and FaceTime.
Thank God for WhatsApp calls. Lots of WhatsApp calls.
That's great. Now, I want to speak about your internship at QH, which is essentially a short-term experience for those that graduate in medicine from the UWI to gain experience in practical areas of the profession. What was your internship like, and how did it inform your understanding of the correlation between the theory of medicine and practical administration?
Internship was one of the toughest years of my professional life, but it was also an extremely fun time. I think the beauty about having done medical school at UWI is that from our third year, from third to final or fifth year, we are exposed to patient care very heavily. We are expected to be very heavily involved with patient care. And so they are, and everyone would say, in your final year, you should be acting in the capacity of a
doctor.
Of an intern. So the transition was not terribly hard as compared to maybe our peers in the US, where, you know, it's a stark difference. So I would say that made it a lot easier. But of course, we are now independent doctors. We can make our own decisions. I definitely grew a lot more confidence in my clinical decision making. But it was taxing. I mean, we did on call every 4 days for 36 hours for an entire year, sometimes one in every 3 days. So it was definitely a very grueling time, but my friends and I, we worked extremely hard. We played hard as well. So it was a great time.
Now, I want to ask you this next question, because a couple of doctors who were here spoke about it. Dr. Brittany Small, who's actually Malcolm's daughter, she graduated last year. And Dr. Corey Ford both spoke about it. And it's about emerging doctors experiencing post-traumatic stress after experiencing the death of a patient. What was that experience like for you?
It's never easy losing a patient, especially if you feel like they were yours. I would go back to, I worked at the COVID-19 isolation facilities after internship, and I think that was the first time a patient's death hit me hard. And I would never forget that. We're seeing these patients because it's isolation, so it's just a few doctors seeing these patients every day. And I saw him deteriorate from being basically unsymptomatic. And I remember these people he passed alone. And I had to be the one to tell his relatives that he passed away. And that was really difficult. But while it's important, you need to be a good doctor, you need to be empathetic and you need to share that grief with your patients. But compartmentalization is also crucial to, you know, getting back up and being your best for the next patient.
So how was it like, though, when you got home and seeing those images that you actually saw? How did it confront you, and how did you evict that whole idea, that whole experience from your feelings?
You know, I think you're also distracted by the fact that there are other patients who need you.
Right.
And the best that you can do for them and for yourself is to prepare yourself for helping the next patient.
Awesome. Now, you joined the ophthalmology department at the QH Hospital before moving to Miami, Florida in 2022 to pursue a research fellowship at the University of Miami's Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, which, by the way, is one of the most highly ranked eye hospitals in the United States. I have to say that. Now, how did the opportunity to study at this university come about?
This is one of my favorite stories. I was working as a locum doctor, so I was coming in when people were going off or on vacation or on study leave in the eye department at QEH. And I remember this one morning I had to call Miss Dawn Grosvenor, who is has been my first mentor, and she's a glaucoma specialist here, so for something completely different, unrelated. And at the end of that call, she said, "Oh, by the way, I have a talk to give at this symposium in Miami on Saturday," and this was Wednesday. And she said, "But I'm not going to make it. They would like someone to present it. Would you be willing to go?" I had no idea what this was about. I didn't know what the presentation was, but I could not pass up this opportunity. So I just said yes. And after that, we dealt with all the details after. But that opportunity there is what really set my path. And everything that has happened since then would not have happened if she did not give me that opportunity and I had not said yes.
That's awesome. Which brings me to the point of mentorship, because I know that there would probably be, well, I suppose, mm-hmm. there probably be a few doctors who would have mentored you while you were at QH. How would you describe that, and who were those doctors?
Absolutely. She was probably my first true mentor, Miss Dawn Grosvenor, but the entire ophthalmology department, Mr. David Callender, who was head of department and our pediatric ophthalmologist here. I also would say Dr. Judy Ward, who's a plastic surgeon. She has been a supporter of mine for a long time. But my colleagues, Dr. Cheyenne Francis, who's part of the ophthalmology department as well, Michelle Dowell, and then my friends. These are all, they may not be in mentorship positions, but they all were supporters of mine and had my back for the entire journey.
And I'm sure that they're proud of you right now.
Yes, yeah. I hope so.
It's like I have backed a good horse, you know what I'm saying, as it were. Yeah, but I want to talk about, once again, about your enrollment at Palmer Eye Institute, because I'm curious about the virtues of so doing. What would you say, how did this help to further your skills as an ophthalmologist?
So the first thing about Bascom Palmer is that it's a very academic institution and very research heavy. We're coming from UWE and Barbados, where in medicine, it's clinical, clinically based. You want to serve the community. And so my research skills were next to non-existent before I left. So right. If it's one thing that I definitely developed in that first year, it was my research skills and building an academic and nurturing my academic thinking. In addition to that, just being exposed to what first world medicine looks like when you have all of the resources available to you, and the things that we may not think about here as physicians or budding physicians because we don't have those opportunities available. So that was another thing, just opening my mind to what the possibilities were. I would also say public speaking. Those skills were definitely tested and nurtured as well. And networking. I don't think I did a lot of that here, but networking was definitely something that we had to work on. I had to work on when I moved.
Now, many of those who travel abroad to study speak lavishly about their transitional challenges in so doing. What is your recall of the challenges you experienced during your transition?
It was the first time I was a minority. Just moving to a different country, moving to Miami specifically. I was, I'm a Caribbean girl, female there. I'm a black woman. And I'm also in a space where I feel like I don't belong in this academic, research-heavy institution. So imposter syndrome hit really, really hard.
What's that?
Imposter syndrome.
What's that?
Where you feel like you don't belong in the space that you're occupying. And I've battled with that we still feel it. I feel everyone experiences that to some extent throughout their lives, but it was hard back then. So I would say that was one of the main challenges, is just feeling like I don't belong, feeling a little nervous to speak up or to share my thoughts and my ideas for fear of not being deemed as important.
Well,
but that it's not the case anymore, but that was definitely one of the biggest challenges. And I would say that's probably one of the only, and missing home,
of course.
Missing home, missing the food and the family.
I was going to say that. No, I have to make this comment. It is remarkable that you seem to have this insatiable thirst for higher education. Yeah. Now, I see that against the background of the completion of your master's in public health from the University of California. How value added would you say has this been to your area of medical specialization?
I decided to pursue my Master of Public Health, not necessarily because of a thirst for further education, just to expand my knowledge, so seeking knowledge. The research that I did while I was at Bascom was population-based research in pediatric visual and impairment in Barbados. Mm. And we pretty much looked at what are the causes and what is the prevalence of visual impairment in kids here. And then when we had those answers, the next step was, well, what do we do next? How can we prevent or lower this prevalence? Mm-hmm. And at the time, I hadn't applied to residency yet. So it was, do I do another year of research here or should I go pursue this degree?
Right.
And I was fortunate enough to have been awarded a grant to pursue my master's of public health. And so that's how that came about. And what happened during that Master of Public Health is what impacted a lot of what we've done in Barbados as the team from Bascom Palmer.
Well, I use the term insatiable thirst in tribute to you because you always seem to be graduating to the next level. I mean, because a lot of people, quite frankly, they just stop, you know, especially when the goings are tough. I'm just going to stop, though. I'm going to get a job. It's over. But that hadn't been your case. And this is so impressive that you kept going and you kept going and you kept going. But having said that, after this next couple of records, we'll get back to more of this conversation involving your growth and development and where you are right now.
Sounds good. Thank you.
I like it a lot, and both of those records were of samples of other records, and I speak constantly in this flight about the extent to which old records make new records. And but the irony is that Puff Daddy's records, more money, more problems, it is so relevant to his situation now, because the truth is, if he didn't have all of that money, there would have been no freak-offs, you get what I'm saying? So his brother had a whole lot of money, you know? And it caused him a whole lot of problems. And a lot of people are saying that, look, this brother might never see the light of day again. Malcolm X, what are your thoughts? You have been following the trial.
Not in total, but I have an idea what's going on. It's very unfortunate. It's sad in this case. Yeah. We got to see what's going to happen, man. Yo.
It's terrible. But
It's funny that Cassie's might be the nail in the coffin for this one.
Yeah.
I mean, her testification. If that's a word.
Yeah, her testimony. Yeah, her testimony. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but look.
But the thing is that the case was not even about that. I mean, we saw what we saw in the elevator and that propelled whatever. But this is all about what's been happening behind closed doors with the sex workers, whatever you call it, that's what this is about.
Well, the racketeer in charge.
The racketeer in charge.
There is a correlation between all that has been going on with him and that charge. Remember, when the feds put their hands on you, they have a case.
They have a case.
They don't move wildly, you know what I'm saying? But my view is, whether or not he's exonerated, he'll never be the same again. Absolutely.
Mentally.
No, well, not only mentally, but in relation to the way people see him and respect him as a mogul. Mm. I mean, I wouldn't want my daughter to grow up Puff Daddy trying to make no records, though. Mm. Real talk. And you know what I'm saying? If I got a son. Because when Jacob was trying to get a deal, Bad Boy Records was one of the labels that it was supposed to go to. And I'm like, oh, no. But even back then, my apprehension existed. Wow. You know what I'm saying? Okay. But anyway, it's a great story. Well, not great. It is fascinating, to say the least.
Trini Guyanese cuisine at its best. We've got that taste you won't forget. Foreplay Deli. Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great great service with a smile. Got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at Four Play Deli. We got the taste you won't forget.
Four Play Deli, located at Sheraton Mall.
The Beat 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
And just in case you're thinking that that commercial you just heard is all contrived and all, you know what I'm saying, trying to deceive you and to a kind of agency to trick you, you know, you can come to Four Play Deli Sheraton Mall and see for yourself. I mean, we are quite democratic, you know what I'm saying? All the food is there displayed, and you know, you make your choice, essentially, of what you want. All the curries are there that they... My girl just mentioned about the curry lamb that she thinks about when she's in San Francisco. She wants curry lamb.
White rice.
You know what I'm saying? White rice. You know what
I'm saying? Curry roti, the what is it? Not the curry.
This chew lamb.
This chew lamb roti. That's it right there.
The back of loves.
They got lamb. They got rice. They got chan. They got what,
doubles. Alibi.
They got
everything we got.
They got juices. They got Rasali tickets. What else we ain't got though?
I don't know. We got everything, baby.
Get your tickets. Okay.
But what we got right now, we have this amazing Barbadian physician who is here telling us about her incredible story from the days of Harrison College, and I got it right this time, Harrison College, to now. Kirsten, it was really pleasing though to have read that you spearheaded a childhood vision screening pilot program called the Pediatric Preventable Blindness Initiative while at the University of California. Now, I'm desperately curious about the motivation behind this huge initiative.
Yes, this was a fantastic opportunity and a really good program that we did. And this all started when I mentioned that Dr. Grosvenor asked me to present at a symposium. It was for the Pediatric Preventable Blindness Initiative. And this is a program that was founded by a pediatric glaucoma specialist by the name of Dr. Alana Grajewski, who worked at Bascom Palmer at the time. And the program is designed to reduce pediatric blindness worldwide by capacitating non-medical workers to perform vision screenings while children came for their routine vaccination. So in public clinics across the country or what have you. And it was first piloted in Suriname. Mm-hmm. And so that symposium was to share the results from Suriname. And one of our own, Dr. Christina Dowell, played a really instrumental part in the success of that. And so the next step was to bring it to Barbados.
Right.
And so that's where my involvement came. So before we even came to do the screening, we did a lay of the land and we wanted to see what the pediatric visual impairment looked like in Barbados in kids. And so we spent a year, the team from Miami and some of us here, very collaborative effort to look and see what those causes were. And then when we found that most of the causes of pediatric visual impairment is reversible and avoidable. So we said there is a need for a screening. We have an excellent vaccination rate in Barbados. We have pretty good access to free healthcare and vaccinations across the country at all the 9 polyclinics. And so we worked with the Ministry of Health. We worked with all the MOHs at the polyclinics. Mr. David Callender, who's our only pediatric ophthalmologist, Ms. Dawn Grosvenor. It was a very collaborative effort. And we screened 120 children over 5 days at 7 polyclinics. And we had a referral rate of about, I think it was 9%. And so we found that this is something that could be used. And so that was a fantastic endeavor. I'm really grateful to everyone who played a part in the success of that. And thankfully now, though our model isn't what's being used, pediatric vision screening is available to children across Barbados now.
And it is against that background I want to ask you about, based on your research in the area of pediatric visual impairment, what's the cause of this condition? And how would you describe the rate here in Barbados compared to the United States?
The main causes of visual impairment here are uncorrected refractive error, which is pretty much the need for glasses. If you have nearsightedness or farsightedness or astigmatism, which is easily corrected by way of glasses.
Right.
So the issue with that is that children, if children aren't screened for that before they're around 8, 9 years old, whatever visual loss has occurred before then is permanent. So if it's detected early, they're given glasses early, then you avoid potential vision loss. It was uncorrected visual refractive error, and then allergic eye disease. A lot of the kids here suffer from allergic eye disease, and if they're rubbing their eyes, you can have issues with the very front of the eye, the cornea, which can also be visually threatening. But the main one was uncorrected refractive error. Our rate was about 2.4%. Visual impairment, 2.4% in kids in Barbados, which is comparable to the US. I think it's 3%, so I dare I say it's less.
Yeah.
But worldwide, it's about 2.8%. So we aren't worse off than
the United States.
Yes.
Now, Kirsten, Dr. De Silva, Kirsten, the challenges involved with raising a visually impaired child, I imagine, has to be insuperable in one hand and excruciating on the other. But having said that, what are some of the obvious signs parents should be mindful of when a child is presenting issues with their vision?
I would break that down into very young children and as they're getting to school age. As a baby, parents can look out for any visible abnormality. If you notice that the child's eye is, there's a squint. If the child is in, if the eye is
squinting
in or outward, that's definitely something to have checked out early. If you see something like an opacity or something white on the eye, that's another reason for concern. If the child is not following objects, as you have a baby and you're showing toys and you realize they're not focusing on the object or following that object, that's another cause for concern and definitely something to take to see a doctor. But as the child gets a lot older, when they're going to school, if they're holding things very close to them to read, if they're sitting really closely to the TV, if you realize that they are not doing well at school, people may not think that has anything to do with vision, but if they're not concentrating, if they can't see, then they're not going to pay attention in class. In fact, a lot of, when we did our study, we found a lot of the referrals to ophthalmology was from school teachers. Kids were complaining of headaches, they're not paying attention in class, or they're sitting really close to the
television
board.
The board, yeah.
Yeah, and squinting. Mm-hmm. So these are all things that I would say parents should look out for. And bear in mind, even if you may not think it has anything to do with vision, those are some things to look out for.
Now, you have made, and this is quite interesting, quite frankly. Now, New York, you know, remember I said insatiable thirst? You know, how ingenious is that? But New York had been your next stop. You worked as a technician there, but soon decided that it better fits your ambition to continue in the area of global eye health. Yeah? So you moved to San Francisco. Tell us about that.
After I completed my Master of Public Health, I had applied to residency for the first time and I was not successful. So that meant, what do I do for the next year? I thought I was going to start residency. I'm not. So that's where the job search started. Yeah. And that's where things got really challenging because I'm not from here. I'm on a visa, a student visa.
Right.
And it was the first time you feel so qualified, but no one wants to give the person who's not from here a job. And so after maybe 4 or 5 months of looking for a job, I found one in New York. I had friends and family there. San Francisco is very far. It's very expensive to live. And I didn't have a big support system there at the time. So I moved to New York and I got this job as an ophthalmic technician at a private office. And I worked there and applied again. So I applied again and I wasn't successful for the second time. And at that point, I remember talking to my parents. They were like, maybe you should come home. You know, can you do this again? And after maybe 2 weeks of grieving, not having matched the second time, I had reached out to some persons that I met when I was going to University of California, Berkeley. And that's where networking comes into.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
To your point.
So in the first job search, I had reached out to the people at Proctor Foundation at University of California, San Francisco, they didn't have any availabilities at the time. So at this time, I reached out again and I said, do you have anything for me? I really would like to stay in the global health and ophthalmology space. And thankfully, their coordinator had just matched. And so the timing was so
perfect.
It was perfect. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to move back to the West Coast, but it was the best decision. Mm-hmm. It was hard, but packed my bags and I went back there, and that's how this all
came about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Truly awesome. Now, I want to talk about your role as research coordinator at the University of San Francisco. How would you describe it?
That was very transformative. The Proctor Foundation at the University of California, San Francisco is an international research foundation in infectious diseases and in ophthalmology. And I was brought on for a newly federally funded research project that was doing an international surveillance of organisms that cause infections of the eye. And so I really had the opportunity to, what I did was onboard different sites, and I'm talking countries in Africa, countries in Asia, across the United States. Mm. So I really got to see what it took to do research and what collaboration really looks like to carry out these huge research projects. You know, collecting samples, training each of the people at the sites, and just communicating. It was a lot of communication. It was a lot of collaboration. And I was really sad to have left, but it was a really good experience.
Now, Kirsten, February of this year could be described as a watershed for you because you successfully matched into ophthalmology residency at the prestigious Howard University, Washington, D.C. Now, suffice to say, there were two previous attempts. Now, how loudly did this extraordinary achievement speak to your emotions?
I still can't describe it. It felt like, I don't think I fully accepted it. I think when I start is when I will
When will you start?
I start at the end of June. Good. So next month. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a very challenging past 4 years. And this is, I ate, slept, breathed, getting into residency for the last 4 years. So this really was, I remember it was 5 a.m. when we got the results. And it was 8 a.m. in Barbados. So I woke my parents up. We did it on FaceTime. And the year before, I also did the same thing, but that was a different result. And I remember just being at peace the night before and saying, whatever happens, I have given it all
shot.
That I have given. Mm. Whatever is to be will be. And it was cathartic. I broke down crying.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, it was. I'm so blessed. I'm so grateful.
Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you, though, what does this ascendancy mean to your career now as an ophthalmologist?
Well, I mean, I am finally going to be practicing ophthalmology again after 4 years of research and other things. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be able to become qualified and be able to give back
to
the people that my people in the Caribbean and Barbados, and to serve them the way that I've always wanted to serve them.
Now, I want to talk about this issue that's of vital importance. Now, gender bias, race, obviously, as well as territorial discrimination, and the last in particular, are issues which I suppose would have confronted you along this fascinating journey to reach the call of career ambition. Now, what is your recall of some of the adversities you would have faced regarding what I just mentioned?
I would say the gender part, I didn't feel as much because most of my mentors were women and they were powerhouses in their fields. And so these are, you know, very strong, very vocal, very loud women who empowered me to also be that way. I don't think I felt the sexism, for lack of a better word, as much as I felt not being a citizen, not being American. And going back to in the job hunt, that was very difficult time being so overqualified, and I'm applying to jobs that I'm super overqualified for and I still can't get them because of my visa status.
So the issue, the term I just used, the word territorial would have been applicable in this regard, yeah?
Absolutely. Mm. And then as an international applicant in a specialty like ophthalmology where it's extremely competitive, there are, I think, 120 programs in the States. They're very small programs. And so it's already a very competitive specialty. And they tell us it's impossible for an international applicant to get in.
Impossible.
There impossible. I've had people tell me you're better off doing another specialty and then maybe try to get in afterwards. But
you believed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the one thing I would say is you can't take no for an answer, and you have to know yourself and know what you want.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Now, I've just painted, and you've noticed the chronological portrait of this incredible journey to ophthalmology, from being a student at Harrison College to through the doors of Howard University, Washington. Yeah? Now, the reality is, though, many of your contemporaries have remained in the same spot as they were when you embarked on this journey 4 years ago. But having said that, what advice would you give to young Barbadian women that are hesitant to take a leap in faith, the extent to which you have, in order to reach to higher ground of their education and skills?
I would tell them a few things. The first thing is you have to believe in yourself, in your vision, first and foremost and the most. Because if you don't, you can't convince anyone else to believe in you and to feel like, see your value. That would be number one. Number two is never take no for an answer. So we all experience rejection. We all experience setbacks in anything that we're pursuing. But my rejections, my two previous rejections, I had to think of those as not yet and maybe not this way, rather than this is not for you. And so in those moments when you're at your lowest, that's when you have to pick up and be resilient and go on. So I would say don't take no for an answer. I would also say to seek help, ask for help, seek support, look for mentors. Because you can't do it alone. I had an entire village. I stand on the shoulders of very tall giants. And you can't do these things alone. But at the same time, be very discerning with who you share your information and your visions with. Because one, not everyone has your best interest at heart.
Nope.
But also not everyone understands.
Exactly.
And I, from personal experience, had I listened to some people, I probably would never have applied this third time.
No.
So I would tell them that. And then never compare yourself and your journey to others, because that will only set you back.
Absolutely.
And whenever you can, pay it forward, especially coming from, Barbados, the Caribbean, where we're not as developed as other countries. However you can help the next person who's looking to do it, just do it.
And to your point, there are people out there that wouldn't want you to succeed because they measure their success by your failure, you see. But having said that, I want to ask you this. To what extent do you believe that the favor of the Lord had been on your life, given all you've just mentioned?
My journey with the Lord has been a whirlwind. And I think within the last year is when I really tried to focus on Him and lean on Him rather than on my own understanding and my own, worldly things. And so I think everything happened when He wanted it to happen for me. And I had to let go and just say, I leave it in your hands.
Now we are in the twilight of this absorbing conversation. So I'd like to end by asking you this. Now, based on this trajectory that your career is on, I say to you prophetically, despite the fact that I don't have the prophetic anointing, that the name Dr. Kirsten De Silva will one day be in the picture frame of several medical institutions across America. Your achievements in just 5 years, literally, have been outstanding, to say the least. But having said that, what is your vision for the further development and the showcasing of your skills as an ophthalmologist over the next 4 years? Because you've come for the next four years.
The next 4 years, I will be in training, and I hope to do a fellowship after for a year. But everything that I have been doing for the last 4 years has been with the vision of improving public eye care in Barbados and the wider Caribbean. And so I hope to leverage the work, the relationships, and the connections that I've made whilst in the United States at these academic institutions to help facilitate exchange of resources, exchange of research between our island, our region, and them, to help strengthen our eye care in the region. And however I'm able to do that, whether that's being here all the time or doing this remotely, I want to contribute and give back.
Awesome. Congratulations. Thank you for coming. And you've just joined the army of powerful young women that are contributing to your society. And the point you just made just now touched me, the idea of giving back and lifting our nation beyond where it is. That is truly awesome. I think our Prime Minister would be proud of you if she hears this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very
for
much,
coming.
Philip. Thank
I appreciate you.
You.
Thank you. So yeah, you heard it. That was Dr. Kirsten De Silva, incoming ophthalmology resident at the Howard University, Washington, D.C. And she just presented to you her entire journey from just believing that she can do this, that she could do this, and she will do this, from the days of Harrison College to where she is now. A great conversation, and a lot of what she spoke about, she used the word resilience. She spoke about not taking no for an answer, and moreover, she spoke about the favor of the Lord that she believed that has always been on her life, which essentially has been the foundation of where she has become. Great conversation. And I hope that many of you young women out there would see this as inspiring and perhaps want to be like, not like her, of course, but to kind of like be a template of exactly what she is and where she's going. Great stuff. We continue right now with the music, and we're going to take it nice and slow here in the Beat 104.
Don't forget Rest Holly and Friends next Saturday, okay? Next Saturday, Gymnasium. Get your tickets from 4Play Deli. They got them, okay? Was he going to get your roties, okay? Antigua King Short Shirt from Grenada. Jab King Torpery. Porsa from St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Gillo from St. Lucia. Trinidad Bringer the Heat with Ben Jai. Porza. Super Blue, Ronnie McIntosh, Baron King Crazy, and Gypsy from Barbados. Blood, Biggie Irie, Young Eiley, Red Plastic, Bag Mighty, Gabby Macfingold, Serenader, and the man himself, Ras Sali. General admission, $100, more at the door, okay? The third one, and it's going to be the biggest one. Like Captain Forrester, let me get my coat to put in my seatbelt.
Oh, yeah. We're 8 miles southeast of Classics International Airport. We'll be landing shortly. In preparation for landing, please ensure that your seatbelts are securely fastened and your tray tables stowed. Our cabin attendants will be coming around the aisles to retrieve any service items you may have used on board our flight today. Remember, smoking is strictly prohibited until you exit the terminal building here at Classics International Airport. This is the end of Flight 104 to Classics for today, May 25th, 2025. On behalf of my guest, Dr. Kirsten De Silva, my co-pilot Malcolm X, 4Play Deli Sheraton Mall, and this radio station, this is Captain Forrester saying goodnight. And remember to walk on the sunny side of the street. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Classics International Airport. Local time is approximately 5 p.m. For your safety and comfort, please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the captain turns off the fastened seatbelt sign. This will indicate that we have parked at the gate and that it is safe for you to move about.
On behalf of the entire crew, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this trip, and we're looking forward to seeing you on board again in the near future. Have a nice day.
Sheraton Mall.
Radio.
The Beat, 104.1 FM.
That's got me feeling this way.
From Barbados.
It beats me black and blue, but it loves me so good, and I can't get enough. Must be love on the radio.
The Caribbean. We are always here.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
For you. The Beat, 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.